because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm Jason Stein.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin Eye's Week in Review. J.R. Ross is on vacation, and I want to thank my capital partner, Jason Stein of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, for sitting in. Jason, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Let's go through the topics of this week. We've talked about it before, but the Great Lakes Compact, created in 2008, finally working, signing off to let Waukesha slip up pretty big straw in Lake Michigan. That's a pretty big deal, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, and we see Governor Walker calling this a victory of science over politics. And I think that's true as far as it goes. No one knew if you would actually see one of these things get approved.
Right.
But at the same time,
anybody could have blocked it.
Anybody could have blocked it. But here's the catch. The science is just beginning and the politics is just beginning. And to get that approved, to get those 8 unanimous yay votes, they had to agree to a number of conditions and a lot of monitoring by other states. And so one of the questions that I have is, how does that play out when you have states like Michigan or Minnesota that are monitoring what a city in Wisconsin does with its water supply? I mean, that is going to be fascinating to watch, and I think not easy for the city of Waukesha to deal with.
Yeah, I agree. Let's look at some of the conditions that were attached before that 8-0 vote. First of all, Waukesha originally wanted more than 10 million gallons a day. That was cut to 8.2, and then the Great Lakes states can take enforcement actions or the compact itself. And then finally, this provision with 30 days' notice, the Waukesha Water Utility records can be audited. So those are no minor changes or concessions.
Right. I mean, if you think about a city in one state being regulated on its water, which is about the most key thing besides maybe police and fire that a city can provide, right? You think about how that's going to play out. That's going to be really fascinating to see and a really fascinating test case. You also have environmental groups, private environmental groups, that have not ruled out suing. That could be from within Wisconsin. That could be from without Wisconsin. So this thing is obviously going to see a number of challenges going forward. That being said, it is remarkable that it has made it this far.
Right. And let's just listen for a minute, a little bit more than a minute, to what Governor Walker said and the mayor of Waukesha said. So let's listen in.
Well, this vote that was taken within the last 24 hours shows that the compact works. That's really what the most important headline should be: the compact works. This really, though, ultimately shows that science triumphs over politics, that if you get the science right, that water is important, public health is important, economic development is important, infrastructure is important. All these things are tied together with this victory. I want the people of the state to be safe. A court has made it clear that there's an expectation that there is a safe water source. You had a whole series of governors, Republican and Democrat alike, from the full span of the political spectrum, from very conservative, very liberal, all sign off on this because they share the same interest we do, whether they represent people in Waukesha or not, is they believe that people should have clean water. And that's what this is about. This is about public health and access to clean water.
The estimated cost of the construction is $207 million. That estimate is a couple years old. It will be, like I said, we're going to be hiring consultants. We have a lot of work to do in figuring out what the costs are, what the route is, what permits are required, going through the process of getting those permits. So our best estimate at this point is $207 million.
As the governor said, Jason, the triumph of science over politics, he said in that press conference, I didn't make any calls to any of these governors. And remember the governors, Mark Dayton and Scott Walker, different parties. So the triumph of science. But I want to highlight what the mayor said. Our last estimate, which he hinted is very out of date, $207 million in improvements, potential upper on City of Waukesha homeowners of $900. But what are the political ramifications potentially of the governor helping out Waukesha, which is in, Waukesha County, which is a bedrock of Republican politics?
Right. Well, I definitely think the governor was right to triumph this as an accomplishment. I mean, this is kind of a first of its kind deal. No one knew if this could be done. It was done. I think the challenge going forward will be, though, you will have other states that are democratically controlled that will be imposing, that may come and try and take actions on sort of the bastion of Republican politics in Wisconsin. So it would be naive to think that there won't be challenges and frustrations and tensions that arise if a Democratic state like Minnesota tries to step in and do something to the city of Waukesha's water, right? The other thing that I think is that this is not building an oil pipeline, but there will have to be a water pipeline built, and there will also have to be then treated water discharged into the Root River, a tributary of Lake Michigan.
Which will be monitored.
Correct. So don't think for a second that that isn't going to produce tensions from real or argued environmental concerns to just, you know, not in my backyard type concerns of people that may, you know, have a water pipeline in their vicinity.
But it's a big win for Waukesha and Republican Waukesha County for the governor's administration to push this across the finish line. It's a big deal.
The city desperately, every city needs water. Every city needs water that is not polluted. And so obviously to get this far is a big step.
Yep. Okay. New topic. The three finalists for Justice Prosser, who will be leaving the court on July 31, end of next month, were announced. Two Court of Appeals judges, Mark Gundrum, Thomas Ruse, and Milwaukee attorney Daniel Kelly. Talk about the legal political pedigree of each.
Sure, of course. Obviously, both Ruse and Gundrum are Walker appointees. Of the two of them, Walker clearly has more of a connection to Mark Gundrum. They both served as assembly lawmakers. I think as well, Gundrum simply has a lot of experience and we can, in different areas, and we can talk about more about that. Dan Kelly, though, as well, is someone who represented Republicans in a redistricting case, you know, big political implications over how legislative district lines are drawn.
Was he a key attorney in that fight in federal court?
He was involved, and he has been involved in other Republican, you know, important conservative things like the Kern Family Foundation. He was general counsel for a while. They fund a lot of important conservative causes and work. So, I mean, he's somebody that's obviously very you know, keyed in to Republican politics, also helped the campaign of Justice Bradley, Rebecca Bradley, who was just won election in her own right after being appointed by Walker. So all three of them have a pedigree here they can draw on.
Well, do you agree with me that if we were betting people, which of course we're not, we might bet on Mr. Gundrum? I mean, because he served in the assembly and then the governor named him to the Waukesha County Circuit Court bench, then named him to the Court of Appeals, and he's got the military background. He served in the Guard.
Right. I mean, you just look at his breadth of experience, and you also look at his own independent political profile. This is someone who won election to office in his own right. He's from, you know, a bedrock Republican suburb, you know, very key part of the state to be from. Yeah. If you're a Republican, he has been, you know, he's been a veteran, he's been overseas, he's been the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the Assembly, he's been a judge, he's been a private attorney, and he has a direct personal connection with the governor. So you look at all those things, you know, that gives him an amount of vetting that someone who has never, you know, held, you know, run in a lot of competitive elections might not have. Obviously, you know, at least in a Republican primary, it was competitive for Gundrum. So I just think you look at all those things and you think, okay, this is probably the
one other thing strikes me about Judge Gundrum. He had a chance when J.B. Van Hollen said, I'm not going to seek re-election attorney general. You know, his name came up and he quickly said, no, this is where I am for now. But the beauty of this appointment is if you get it, you don't have to run until April of 2020.
Right.
Because Ziegler's up and Abramson's up and Gableman's up.
Right.
Gableman, Ziegler, Abrahamson.
And let's not forget, too, that if Walker chooses Gundrum, there would be at least the possibility that Kelly could apply for that appellate judge position. So there is that as well. Whereas obviously, you know, you can't give if somebody remains in private practice, you can't. You know, that job is going to be their job.
Well, we're talking about the Supreme Court. Let's talk about yesterday's 5-2 decision. It pretty much said that the Republican passed law 2013 that local municipalities could make their residents live within the boundaries of their communities. No, that was struck down. And this case was brought by Milwaukee, where your comrade Mary
Spicuzza
reported one out of every five city of Milwaukee workers live outside. So
already.
Right now.
Right.
Right, and that's expected to go. So that was 5-2 with the traditional Gableman, Prosser, Ziegler, Rogenczak, and Bradley writing the majority, or siding with the majority, and Abramson and Walsh Bradley disagreeing. I think that was a pretty significant opinion.
Well, I do. I think it had some bedrock constitutional issues. One, the issue of local control, to what extent local elected officials can make decisions for their constituents versus individual rights, to what extent those rights of individual public workers cannot be abridged by local officials. And, you know, I really think this residency requirement was in place, I believe, since the 1930s, in any case, many decades. And I think really the impact of this, to see this, this is not something where we'll just see next year or the year after. I mean, this is something where I think really you need to look back in 10 or 20 years, and it, you may find profound impacts from it when you look at it at that distance.
I agree. And Gableman in his ruling said, yes, Milwaukee, you have a city ordinance, but because this is such a statewide issue, we're voiding your city ordinance. It was a pretty amazing decision.
Absolutely.
Pretty interesting. Okay, next topic. Let's talk presidential politics, but let's focus in on it this way. Governor Scott Walker, on July 18th through 21st, will lead Wisconsin's delegation to the Republican National Convention. He will be the leader as a governor of the state. And then you have U.S. Speaker Paul Ryan. So the, I'm going to use the term oblique or generic way, what they said this week. Here, let's just read them. Speaker Ryan, the last thing I would do is tell anybody to do something that's contrary to their conscience. I get that this is a very strange situation. Donald Trump is a very unique nominee, and the governor, historically, not just this year, delegates are and should be able to vote the way they see fit. We'll see how things go between now and the convention as to what the next steps are. Jason, is this a little wink, wink? Don't sell out to Trump yet, and we may not have heard the final chapter.
Right. So, I mean, let's just take a step back and think about the context of these two men, right? They have an incredible position within the Republican Party, both in Wisconsin, which it could be a key battleground state, again, certainly has been in the past, and nationally within their party. So they are truly people that can sway individual rank and file party members as well as other elected officials. They could have said, you absolutely must support Donald Trump. He's our party's nominee.
Yes.
We really dislike Hillary Clinton. You must support him. They could have said, do not support Donald Trump. They could have given reasons for that. And instead, they take this, they attempt this middle path where they say, we personally support his, we personally back him, but we understand that not everyone may reach that conclusion. So I think if you sort of think about what they could have done,
yes,
you get a sense of, well, this is where they're at.
Well, as the chairman of the delegation, the governor said, look, our state GOP rules require us to vote for Cruz because he won the state on April 5 on the first ballot.
Right.
So that seems to me, okay, we know where we have to be on the first ballot,
right,
unless Senator Cruz releases us, which he's
right.
showing.
Has that happened? I don't recall that happening.
You and I haven't missed that one, my friend. So it's just this very unique dance, isn't it?
It really is. And I think if you sort of think about it, if you really step back from it, how remarkable it is. And I think the fact, too, that you look at where Donald Trump is at the polling, he's not where George W. Bush was. He's not where Mitt Romney was in 2012. He's not where John McCain was in 2008. So
yes,
this is a nominee who, both in terms of his organization, his fundraising, his poll numbers right now, is struggling. And if he's only going to receive the most nominal support from key party officials like Paul Ryan and Scott Walker, that gives you a sense of the incredible challenge that he faces. And then you also have to step back and say, if he wins or if he does not win, what does that mean? It's certainly he doesn't owe much to Paul Ryan if he ends up winning. And if he doesn't win, are there repercussions? Do people point fingers and say, do they say that's Donald Trump's fault for losing them?
Yeah.
Or do they say, is that, Governor Walker's fault for not helping Donald Trump more.
Trump is just continues to amaze everybody. At this morning's press conference on the UK vote to exit the European Union, he was asked, "Do you like making these fundraising calls?" And he said, "No, I hate them." Because he said, "My history has been the politicians calling me." The book that I want to read, Jason, is the one written by Reince Priebus. Don't you want to read that one? It's the Eye of the Storm.
Right. Obviously, Kenosha native.
Yes.
And RNC chairman Reince Priebus, who has presided over what has been so far a very difficult cycle. It's really not over. A lot can happen between now and November, but I don't think you see any Republicans saying that they right now are standing where they had hoped to be and where they could have stood, I think, very plausibly had things gone differently.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Okay, the next subject is, I was out of the state, but I was really impressed with a story that one of your fellow reporters in the Journal Sentinel did. And she said, he or she said, doesn't matter, that delaying X number of major highway projects, now just four of them, have boosted the cost of their eventual construction by at least $700 million. So I was really struck by that story. And we're talking here about U.S. Highway 10 and State Highway 441 in the Fox Valley. The upper there is 23.5%. The 3990, expanding that between Madison and Illinois, up 67%. The Verona Road Interchange, which is our version of the Zoo Freeway here in the Madison area, is up 86%. U.S. Highway 18, Prairie du Chien, 46.4%. State Highway 15, New London, 18.4%. This points up a larger impasse between the governor now, has laid down the markers again. My budget will not include any upper in our 30.9 cent gas tax or $75 vehicle registration fee. But the natives, the GOP natives in the legislature, are getting increasingly restless. Agree?
No, absolutely. And I think just the point of that story is, you know, not all of those cost increases were due to delays that came about because of elected official decisions.
Thank you, because you're right.
But the point is that inflation inflates. When you wait, costs typically are going to go up. Not always, but it's a pretty reasonable assumption in the current environment that costs will go up. And so the point is, the longer you take to solve this problem, the problem doesn't get smaller, it is most likely going to get bigger. And so, you know, Republicans have fought over a potential revenue increase, a gas tax increase, a fee increase, to try and solve this imbalance between what we are scheduled to spend on mm-hmm. roads and the money that we will have to spend on those projects. And now the governor is signaling that, hey, I'm going to look at maybe what is a more typical Republican thing, which is to cut projects or find other ways we can spend less.
Or delay them, hang them out more.
Right, but then you come back to the costs. Then you come back to the costs inflating over time. The only way you avoid that is to actually say to a town, you're not going to get that bypass, or you're not going to get that widening of this highway.
Let's bring it home. You remember the deal? The compromise was, let's bond, and bonding will complete the east-west leg of the Zoo Freeway, but as a compromise with legislators from up north, no additional work done on the north-south leg of the Zoo Freeway, so we have no idea when the north-south leg of the Zoo Freeway is going to be done, and that's just a huge public work project. But how does this set up for the next budget? Now that Walker has telegraphed, there'll be no gas tax increase, no motor vehicle registration fee. And is he going to recommend more bonding? We're bonding, as you know, $850 million in this two-year budget cycle.
Right. You know, I think up to a certain amount, you can do a certain amount of borrowing without pushing up sort of the ratio of debt
service. How much of it goes for debt service?
Right. You can do a certain amount of borrowing within a household, and you're still paying the same percentage of your income to loans. But after a certain point, if more and more of your income is going to your mortgage and your credit card and your car payment, then it's not sustainable anymore. Right. And so that's what they have to find is how do they get that sustainability? And I think, you know, in their defense, I think many voters have signaled they don't want to see that sustainability from a gas tax. Others say they do. But at a certain point, then I think the elected officials may feel it's incumbent on them to go to the voters and say, well, look, here's the other option. The other option is, okay, we don't do that revenue increase, right, but here's what it's going to mean concretely in terms of either higher costs or fewer projects that you want. And then it's on the voters to say, what do we want?
The Joint Finance Committee will begin acting on the budget next, late May or June. And you and I know that between March and April, there's going to come a memo from the Department of Transportation. If we don't come up with additional revenues, here's the next list of projects that are going to be pushed out 4, 5, and 6 years. That's when legislators go, maybe we should find a way.
Right. And here's one of the things that I have really struggled as a reporter to do is I think in fairness to our readers, in fairness to the public and voters, they need to know if the revenues don't go up, if taxes don't go up, what happens? What is the proposal to? And I think that's whether you're a lawmaker that opposes that or whether you're a governor that opposes that. I think it's really incumbent on people to say, well, what is the other option? Because then democracy can work.
Yeah.
But if you don't know what that option is, if it only happens after you choose,
yes,
if you only find out afterward, then how can people make an informed choice? But it's very difficult as a reporter or as a lawmaker to get that information unless it's coming out of the administration, because they're the people who have hundreds of engineers. Nobody else has that.
Right, which is why, going back to the power of the Journal Sentinel story, let's just take the Verona Road intersection.
Sure.
The cost of it, by delaying it, stretching it out, up 86% between 2011 and 2016. Anyway, okay, enough on that. There was no rewind last week, so let's quickly summarize three things in the last Marquette University Law School poll. First of all, on presidential, Secretary Clinton 46%. Now we're dealing here with likely voters, and Donald Trump 37%. I was struck in that poll, 13%, none of the above, neither. You surprised by that?
It is a large number, and if you look at the national polling, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, is also polling, I think, in the high single digits, something like that, which is that's a significant number for him to be polling at. Certainly enough that he could potentially play the spoiler in a close election. So it is so unusual to look at the unfavorable numbers of both candidates. But once again, you have to look at Donald Trump and say, how does he dig out if he doesn't have money? If he doesn't come up with money, if he doesn't come up with more support from national Republicans, where does that, how do you change that narrative? Because it's as unpopular as Hillary Clinton is, Donald Trump is more unpopular. And these are two of the best known people in America. So once people make up their minds that, okay, I'm going to favor this one is a little bit of the lesser evil to me, how do you change their minds when they've had decades to make them up? I think that's the really difficult challenge that if you're running strategy for either campaign, especially Trump's right now, that's what you're really grappling
and
with.
And help me remember, history lesson, the last time a Democratic candidate for president won in Wisconsin was...
Lost in Wisconsin?
Yes.
Would have been, 1984,
yeah,
when Walter Mondale lost in a huge... Right. Upset. And I think that's why you're seeing the Clinton campaign, they before Orlando were going to bring the president to Green Bay and do a big event here. It's clear that they're hoping to take Wisconsin off the table early, which would be a blow to the other side.
Yeah, because Wisconsin does matter. Looking at the U.S. Senate in the MU poll, Feingold up 51-42. That's about the range it's been for the last 4 months. I mean, you want to add any PS on that?
No, I think I think the challenge that Ron Johnson has always had is that he really may need to outperform Donald Trump, the Republican nominee for president, or whoever else. If you believe this talk that Donald Trump could be replaced as the nominee, still likely would have to outperform that nominee. And when he is not very well known with people in the state,
Johnson 33%. It's still not known. I don't have enough information. Excuse me for interrupting.
No, that's okay. So again, I think that's a challenge that he faces is this is not a year where he can simply ride the coattails of the person at the top of the ticket. He really can't depend on that. So then how does he distinguish himself? That's That's a challenge that he faces.
And he tries to parse it. I'm so intrigued by how Johnson interacts and what he says about Trump. I support the Republican nominee, but it may not be an endorsement. I mean, so how do you, okay.
It goes back to that most, the nominal, you know, that nominal support category.
Yeah, it does. And then finally, because we always look at it, the governor's approval rating. In the June poll, it was 39%. That's a drop of 4 percentage points since May. Big deal?
I think it's significant. I think two things. One, that President Obama, if you look at that same poll, is reasonably, you know, has a reasonable approval rating in this state. And you have Hillary Clinton really running as sort of a third term of Barack Obama in many ways.
Yeah.
And then you have Governor Walker, who is probably the most, you know, prominent Republican in the state, sort of there with Paul Ryan, being at the moment, you know, very low in approval. So again, that is another struggle for Republicans up and down the ticket, that contrast.
Right. Finally, we couldn't do the show without paying some honor to the memory of Kitty Rhodes. She came out of Hudson, elected in 1998. Then she became co-chair of Joint Finance. She had the ability to laugh, but
absolutely.
By the same token, when the party line had to be, when the hammer had to come down, in the gavel, she brought it down. Then she went over to Health and Department of Health Services, deputy, 2011-2013. Then, the last thing she signed off on was pulling back on the changes to the family care and
long-term care program for the elderly and disabled in Wisconsin.
Right. So, any memories you want to add of Kitty?
You know, absolutely. I mean, there are not perhaps as many in both parties, particularly in the Republican Party, strong female leaders as there could be. She's certainly an example of one who is very successful and rose very high. I always enjoyed sitting down and asking her tough questions. I don't know if she enjoyed it as much as I did, but she was always a pleasure to work with. I'll never forget her as a smoker voting in 2007 to raise the cigarette tax, as an opponent of taxes and a smoker, voting to raise the cigarette tax on herself, as well as expand family care, its biggest expansion ever, even though she was a great skeptic of the program. And so, you know, she really was someone that brought a lot of color to a white granite building.
The last time she sat there, I interviewed her on the dementia programs.
Right.
Because we did a special project. And she was an excellent interview. She knew her stuff. She showed passion. And then after the interview, I walked to the Capitol, and there she was lighting up. So, you know, we're not physicians. We don't know what role her smoking played, but we want to extend our condolences to her family.
She had class. She had color. She was a memorable person. You know, even in a body of 99 assembly members, she was a memorable person.
Right. Okay. Last subject. If you don't have an opponent in the November election, you can worry about what bills you're going to introduce next session. Talk to me about Republican Representative Bob Gannon's bill. Right now, if you put up a sign, no firearms allowed in your business or organization, how does the liability work? Do you escape legal liability?
Right. So right now, already under the concealed carry law that was passed in 2011 by Republicans, this is before Gannon's time. Gannon wasn't in the assembly at this time.
Right.
A business that allows for firearms to be brought in, that doesn't put up a sign saying no firearms, is immune from any liability from what may happen because of the presence of the firearms on their premises. But this would go one step farther and say, if you choose to prohibit firearms in your bar, you know, in your retail, and I think this is mainly aimed at retail business establishments, not only do you not get immunity, you're going to face higher damages. So it's an interesting proposal, especially coming from Republicans who don't typically like to add legal liability to businesses. In fact, that's been one of Governor Walker's very big projects of law, is to reduce the liability, reduce the ways that people can sue businesses and win. This would be a very big exception.
Which, it may not go very far, because you of course, read Speaker Voss's comments. It's not on my short list of bills to act on next session.
He didn't get the sense that was something he was looking. It's not going to happen until, you know, 2017, But he didn't look like he was too eager to have it happen then either.
I agree. Well, that's the news from this week. I'm Steve Walters.
I'm Jason Stein.
And thanks, Jason, for filling in with JR. Rewind will, with JR, be back next week. Thank you.
My pleasure.